Would you like to reserve some time, sir?
I would, about 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Certainly.
Your Honor, please, please, the court. My name is Art Donaldson. I am love counsel with the firm of Davis, 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 Davis. I don't know how many Davis. Many years of practicing law, both in North Carolina and here, have always presented to me unique cases. This is one of them. In that, it is a terrific case for law students, only because it comes down to just interpretation of a statute. I think the briefs in this case, and I don't take credit for the brief, Mr. Hunt did that, Your Honor, for the appellant, and Ms. Johnson's brief, I think both aptly describe the parameters of our review. It's a de novo review, and it's of the statute, and you look at that fresh. But there's so many intriguing things within that statute, and our position is that the concealment statute, which is the one that refers to the definition of a dead body, that definition of dead body, we contend, does not include the definition of female. We say that for a number of reasons. One, because the statute itself, in looking at the entire article, keeps referring to a difference between a dead body and a fetus, or fetal death and death. In other words, fetus is something different than a dead body. As a matter of fact, the very statute itself that we were talking about says the dead body means a human body, or such parts of the human body from the condition of which it reasonably may be concluded that death recently occurred.
But counsel, in this case, and I appreciate your compliment of Ms. Johnson, she always does good work, and the brief in this case is on your side, sets out the issues very well. But I think the problem that we run into in a case such as this is determining what is a life and what is not a life, and that's not the issue in this case. The issue in this case is the disposal of whatever it is, whether you want to call it a life or you want to call it something else. It's the disposal that triggers the criminal culpability in the statute. And the statute, I think, goes to great lengths, and a lot of statutes don't do this, quite frankly, and defines what types of things, materials, fall within the ambit of this statute. And it particularly describes a fetus. Now, we can all kind of have differences of opinion as to what life is, but it says a fetus, and I don't think that there's any dispute here that what was recovered was indeed a fetus.
I don't disagree. And if I was before the Roman Curia, the case would be resolved already, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
But we're not. It is not, and I appreciate that. And I'm not talking about when life begins or when it ends. But I do think the legislature thought about it, and that's why they cut this up into little pieces, because they referred to fetal death and disposing of fetal and reporting of fetal death different than they do of other deaths. I mean, the statute itself refers.
Counsel, is there a difference in terms of describing something called fetal death as opposed to body? Arguably, one is describing an event that happens, and the other is a noun. It's a body, and the part of the statute describing body also talks about the fact that it would be such parts. So, is there a way that the statute could be read that the fetus that was recovered would qualify under the such parts part of the statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think for instance, they talk, the legislature itself talks about after, you know, reporting, for instance, after a gestational period of 20 weeks or more, and they have all these breakpoints, in the statute itself. They've broken it up, we haven't. And so, I must say, from a trial strategy and where we were coming from, was we just looked at the definition of, they told us to look at the definition. We looked at the definition, and the definition clearly said human body, and then we read down, then we saw where they talked about body and or fetus. So they, and then the statute started expanding out, talking about fetus here. You do this if it's 20 weeks, and you do this. And then we had, within ourselves, an internal discussion, you know, of when, if it's true that all fetal deaths have to be reported, and surely we don't think that that was meant to be. I mean, a fetal death would be a death of any product of conception at any time, whether it's 1 week after conception, 2 weeks, 15 weeks, or 20. So what happens if a woman has a miscarriage in her 10th week? Is she bound by the court or by the statute to call up the police or otherwise notify somebody of this event? And who does she call after 6 weeks or 8 weeks? I mean, I know, you know, personally about this in the sense that, well, we all do. But, you know, the miscarriages that my family had were fortunate or unfortunate, they occurred and there were, we were hospitalized. But a lot of people have miscarriages and they never go to a hospital, they never think of it.
But I think the answer to that question, counsel, is what the Supreme Court said in the Hall versus Stewart case. It says a statute contains the dual purpose of imposing criminal liability on those who maliciously conceal a dead body to cover up an unlawful act or detection of the death itself, and also providing for the public health by discouraging the improper disposal of human remains. That's the test that was set out in Hall versus Stewart. And whenever you have the situation where you describe whether it's a miscarriage or something like that, arguably, in those situations, the determination could be made that this was not done maliciously to conceal a dead body or cover up an unlawful act of detection, or has put the public at risk based upon the disposal of the material relating to the pregnancy. So I think that might well be the answer to your question.
Well, I wish that was in the statute, Your Honor, in
but
the sense
Supreme Court said it, 1923, so.
Well, yes, but you know what, not almost with all due respect to the Supreme Court, 1923 is different than in today's date, and this statute itself, as I understand it, goes back, I think, was the code of 1950. But so I don't know that the legislators in their wisdom looked at that statute and said, oh, that's all right, the Supreme Court will fill this in with their rulings in the past.
Yeah, the Supreme Court still gets to make the rules. We can suggest things to them, but that we can't.
I understand. And so we didn't approach it by saying something was unconstitutional or otherwise. We're just approaching it from the words itself. We think there's a serious issue, you know, a lot of this, we don't blame the. I'll leave that. If I was arguing the Roman period, this would be flat, done, decided, be no problem. But we're not dealing with issues of when life begins in this statute at all.
In this case, was there a determination as to how developed the fetus was?
I think the doctor testified 30 weeks or so. I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. 32 weeks, and so if you take a look at that fact in particular, and again, we're not getting into the discussion of when life begins, a fetus at 32 weeks, as I understand, can be viable at 32 weeks. Wouldn't it undermine the purpose of the statute to not allow a potentially viable human being's death to be evaluated and investigated, which is one of the primary purposes of the act?
I think that's reasonable, Your Honor. That's a reasonable approach. But again, I think this is the charge is concealment of that. I agree with you that maybe a better worded statute might do that. But that's not what the in my opinion, in our opinion, that's not what the statute says. I don't disagree with the court. I think we can talk about what the goals of what the statute are.
Sure.
I just wish they had spelled it out more particular in there. I don't want to belabor this point anymore. I think the priests were very good. We've spelled out all the areas in the article wherein they talk about fetus and human body as something distinct, two different things. And we're just saying they're borrowing here and they're borrowing there and not borrowing when it's convenient to them. And I just think they need to be consistent, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you so early because we're talking just about the simple interpretation of the statute. In terms of what Appellant is indicating, it's the definition of body versus what he's arguing as fetus would be different. And for this, the criminal statute refers us to 32.1. Other points of 32.1 seem to make a distinction between body and fetus. Do you want to address that? Specifically, it would be like 32.1264 makes a distinction where it says that. Is that obviously, that's not something that we're bound by, but it's informative as to the fact that the General Assembly meant a difference.
Well, Your Honor, I have two answers to that question. First of all, as the court knows, when applying a statute, there's two steps. First, we just look at that plain language of the statute. And only if it's ambiguous do we turn to the rules of construction and construe the statute. I submit that this is a step one case. The only language that the General Assembly adopted from 32.1 was the definition of a dead body. The General Assembly just lifted that one definition out of the statute. And I think that makes sense. I think that we should have a limited view of that because 32.1 the definitional chapter that we're drawing from is for the purposes of the vital records chapter, not a criminal statute. So I think that the General Assembly was very limited in choosing that language. My second answer to your question, Judge Melo, is that I submit that the language in other parts of 32.1 is not language of distinction, it is language of inclusion that manifests the General Assembly's intent that the bodies of fetuses be subject to many of the same requirements, really all the same requirements, as human remains, the reporting requirements.
Well, I guess the question then is why would you need to treat it differently if they are in fact the same? I think that's the point that essentially is
right.
They made. Why delineate or have a distinction?
Well, again, I don't think it's a distinction. I think that it's a phrase of inclusion, and I think that's because of some of the unique circumstances that come up with fetal remains. If this is something that happens as a result of a procedure or a spontaneous miscarriage or a stillbirth, I think that the General Assembly wanted to be absolutely clear that those remains are also subject to a final disposition. And to put it bluntly, not thrown in the trash. The General Assembly has made it clear that fetal remains should be disposed of by burial, by cremation, or by transport out of the state with the proper papers to do that.
But the point I believe your point of colleague makes, and it's an interesting one, is that when does that obligation arise? A person who has a miscarriage after 3 weeks
Isn't
likely to recover the material from the miscarriage and give it a proper burial or whatever way it's going to be disposed of. When does that obligation occur?
Well, Your Honor, I think that isn't something that's maybe expressly addressed in that certainly sensitive to that issue. You know, many of us have experienced that in our own families, dear friends, and so forth. And certainly, no one is suggesting that someone would be liable for criminal liability in that situation. As the court pointed out earlier, there certainly wouldn't be a malice issue. I think, Your Honor, that for the purposes of, I don't think that the court needs to resolve that question to resolve this case. Because this was a 32-week stillborn child. And I submit that once fetal demise occurs, and there's a stillborn child who is viable, I think that's over whatever that line is.
So your response essentially is that these kinds of situations need to be analyzed on a case-by-case basis.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that. And really, in these kinds of early miscarriage situations, you know, or something that takes place, the second trimester seems to be a dividing line. You know, the end of the second trimester, beginning of the third trimester seems to be a dividing line.
Counsel, then doesn't that put a lot of discretion within the Commonwealth's hands to interpret the statute?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
Doesn't that put a lot of discretion within the Commonwealth Attorney's hands in terms of interpreting the statute to determine whether it's something that's something they can prosecute or not?
I think that's true of every statute, Your Honor.
Well, usually it's a factual basis that they're determining whether they can actually go forward, whether the statute meets what they have before them, not something where they actually have to interpret the statute as to when is that dividing line.
Well, as I said, I think that in this case, that dividing line is clear. I think that we have facts in this case that, and I think, respectfully, I think the court is getting into a question of prosecutorial discretion that isn't raised in the case. You know, we do trust our prosecutors to exercise good discretion and to determine when they have a good factual basis to bring a case. And we largely leave that decision to our prosecutors in the absence of some kind of allegation of malice or malicious prosecution, which there hasn't been in this case. I submit that it would be a case by case determination. You know, I can't imagine someone bringing charges in something that involved a first trimester miscarriage. I just can't imagine that situation.
But I think that's the point that your opponent is making, is it doesn't appear to be clear from the statute as to where that line is. That was the basis of my question, because it doesn't appear that the statute indicates when that line would be.
Well, I would suggest that we could look at, well, no, the statute doesn't, Your Honor. I think that this is a case-by-case analysis. And in this case, this is a 32-week stillborn infant that was viable. We have two doctors testifying that this child was viable. I hate to bring up the abortion statutes, but we do have more restrictions in the abortion statutes after the 28th week.
Doesn't the answer to Judge Malvo's question come down to an assessment as to liability? In other words, the investigating authority, law enforcement, makes a determination as to whether or not a reasonable reading of the statute would suggest that there's probable cause to arrest someone for the action that occurred. And then once it gets to court, they have to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt with the facts and circumstances that exist to suggest that there is actually criminal liability associated with the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that. I do. And that's kind of a bulwark to broad prosecutorial discretion, you know, the burdens that are on law enforcement and the prosecutor. So you know, there is balancing there. And I submit, as the court indicated earlier, in this kind of very early situation, there'd be no malice. And the second interest of the statute in protecting the public health by proper disposal of human remains would not be triggered either. And another point that I kind of wanted to make, even if we go down the line of construing the statute as the appellant suggests, that would affect a lot of other statutes, particularly in Title 32.1 and other criminal statutes, such as our grave robbing statute, only mentions dead bodies. Our statutes involving, you know, some of the funeral regulations only talk about dead bodies. Some of the
all of the strict liability crimes.
All of the strict liability crimes. Yeah. You know, so that's something certainly to think about, is what kind of unintended consequences adopting the appellant's construction of the code, of this code section, could involve.
But arguably we're supposed to presume and must presume that the General Assembly meant the words in their statute.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. That is one of the rules of construction. And going to Judge Alston's point earlier about the 1923 case that talked about the dual purposes of the concealment statutes, the General Assembly is charged with knowledge of the law of the Supreme Court of Virginia. So I submit the best way to view that is that the court, when it established the statute, that the General Assembly, when it passed the statute, was aware of that interpretation. And furthermore, Your Honors, I submit that this case largely turns on common sense. You know, we always look to what the General Assembly is trying to do, or what the harm is that they're trying to prevent. And I believe that in this case, part of the harm in the concealment statute is not only to conceal crimes, is also to protect the public health and well-being, because we just don't dispose of human remains in the trash. It's just not something that we do. And as I think I possibly spoke about earlier, this was a 32-week fetus. The medical examiner testified that because certain signs of decompensation were not present, the death was recent, and the Commonwealth just met the requirements of the statute. If there's other questions, I'm more than happy to continue answering them. I think I have a little bit of time left, but that's our position.
You do, but I don't see any more questions, so thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you.
Mr. Hunt, you have, I believe, almost 4.5 minutes remaining.
Your Honor, we waive that, unless the court has some questions that we'd like to ask.
Are there any questions of Mr. Hunt? No, sir, we don't have any. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will come down and greet counsel. Thank you.